Hello and welcome to Journey of the Monkey King with me, Quiva, and myself, MJ.
Hello.
And myself, I just said, and myself, MJ.
We are one now. Quiva and I have merged into one being, and we're not sure how this will affect the podcast or the format of the podcast, given that, well, I know everything that she knows, and she knows everything that I know, which is nothing. So really, I'm not adding anything except color commentary, which is the podcast anyway. So it's late here.
we're recording this late because we're not actually recording a real episode. This is just a quick intro to say that we went on another podcast just called the Journey to the West podcast. By two lovely guys named Richard and James, who did a kind of a similar project to us, but they've actually gone and finished the book. Props to them for getting the whole way through. Hopefully we will as well.
Yeah, they go a lot deeper into analysis than we do as well.
Yeah.
So if you're liking the story and you feel like you want to know more, dig deeper into the themes and the cultural context, definitely give their show a listen.
Yeah, or if you're just really impatient to get through the rest, I suppose.
If you just need some Sun Wu content. Oh my god! How has that never happened before? How?
This was meant to be just like a quick little intro to a segue to just us playing that episode this week, and it's gone completely off the rails.
Well, I've had a weird day. Sun Wu content. Yes. That's got to be a tagline on everything that we don't use, including the Twitter that we don't use. And that's it.
Anyway.
Look, I made you some Sun Wu content.
Richard and James were kind enough to invite us on to talk about our perspective on the novel. As kind of their wrap up tour for the novel, I guess, now that they've finished it. And so what you're going to hear next is just going to be that recording. And we will return back to the usual story and what happens with Red Boy next time.
Sweet. Talk to you.
Please enjoy.
Welcome back. Just when you guys thought the journey to the West was over, we are coming to you as Buddhas, as Arhats, as Bodhisattvas, having completed this alchemical novel. For those of you readers and listeners who maybe got lost along the way or haven't quite attained the enlightened status that we have, having worked our way through all 100 chapters, we have a treat for you. And for all of you who have, you know, like a certain Bodhisattva's lion decided to go back to the Journey to the West world to cause some havoc, we've also got some people for you. We're talking today with Journey of the Monkey King podcast hosts, Quiva and MJ.
Hello. And,
yo.
Yeah. And we just wanted to introduce you listeners to these people because their podcast is really great. We've listened to their episodes and they've got a slightly different format from us. But I think for some listeners, that might be a welcome thing, because rather than dwelling way too much on the alchemical implications of the Red Boy, for example, and why he sets himself on fire or hits himself in the face, for MJ and Quiva, you get a more comical take. It's more live reaction. It might be a little bit better if you're not into the whole, like, let's figure out why they're talking about the moon for an entire chapter or something.
I think we treat it much more as a story and a novel for an enjoyment. We try not to completely ignore the cultural context of it, and at the very least look into the kind of figures and deities that appear throughout the novel at least a little bit, but maybe we should explain our format to the listeners. I have read the book before, although as has come up, my memory is sometimes not all that good. But
you told me we were done with child murder.
Oh boy, do you guys have a surprise ahead of you if you don't want any more child murder in this book.
For Christ's sake, Quiva! Why are you doing this to me? What have I done to you?
Yeah, so MJ has not read this book, and I'm basically recapping the story to them per chapter as we go along, and doing live reactions to it, and just kind of enjoying the story and the plot and the comedy of it a lot. It's a very good book.
Yeah, we do a little bit of discussion at the end sometimes. As far as I have a background in literally anything, I've got a humanities background, so I try to pick up on little things, but I don't know a lot about the time period. We're trying to, more than anything else, we're trying to work out why the story has endured and moved, you know, and inspired so many things, like, you know, from fucking Dragon Ball Z and all the rest, why it's been adapted so much, and just looking at it as, yeah, as Quiva said, as a story, as something that grips people and entertains people.
Yeah. And that's kind of why I approached MJ about doing this podcast as well. Because I this kind of started as a kick that I was on briefly. I just took a fancy of reading some very old stories, I guess. This didn't last all that long, but I read like the Odyssey, I read the Epic of Gilgamesh. I read the Tonbo Cúlna, which is an Irish epic poem. And I read Journey to the West. And Journey to the West, obviously much more recent than all the other things I mentioned there. The others being epic poems, this being a novel, but still struck me as being very modern, feeling very modern in a lot of ways. In the humor and the kind of the bureaucratic humor, especially of it throughout it, kind of struck me and fascinated me.
Yeah, you can definitely tell that this was written by a civil servant. You know, having done a brief stint as, you know, I guess you'd call it do you use the term civil servant or is it like federal government worker? But having done a brief stint in that bureaucratic environment, it's very that. I know there's some. I think there's a slight delay on my end. I apologize. Sorry, I interrupted you guys.
But yeah, I was just, this is James, by the way, and I've said this a million times in our podcast, but it's, in some ways, these are really ancient stories, and you see the core of this, but the civil service stuff, that's where you see, wow, China, this is something where I can relate to this that I couldn't relate to Shakespeare. Like Shakespeare's plays, you know, Elizabethan England, they started to have a lot of modernity, but they didn't have a civil service, or you wouldn't have identity theft.
Yeah.
Based upon forged documents. You might have identity theft in other ways, in confusion, but like that's something that you wouldn't see in the West till the 19th century in the same manner. In that way, China was so advanced. I can relate to Ming Dynasty China better than I can relate to the cultures of which I was raised in some respects. It's odd that way.
Yeah.
And there's also, I get like you were saying, it feels, even though it's kind of straddles that line between being like a classic epic poem and then something that's more modern, it does feel a bit like Rick and Morty a little bit, if you guys are into that show.
Yeah, I was gonna say, just as a comedian and as someone who's done, you know, played around with a little bit of sketch and sitcom, you've got like before Zhu Baji and the sorry, I'm drawing a complete mind blank on
no worries. Tripitaka,
no, but yeah, before Wu Jing and Zhu Baji come in, you know, you've got very much a comic and straight man dynamic between Tripitaka and Wukong. you know, where they're playing off each other for those few chapters. It's very sitcom like, which is interesting, and it's very almost monster of the week for a little while, and you just get to know these characters and how they react to these situations drives the plot, which I found fascinating. And then you've got like little brick jokes, if there's any TV Tropes fans out there, and all these callbacks like Tripitaka falling off his horse, which I think really adds to it and just does help you relate to it quite a bit.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. And I think that like the kind of Rick and Morty elements as well, it's sort of like they just threw everything in the kitchen sink at it, because I think someone in China, like by the time you get to, if you kind of follow Cuiva's like method, it's like by the time you get to this book, as a person living in medieval China, you've probably read a whole bunch of the other epics and ancient books and sources and religious tales, etc. And so you're kind of, I think, maybe looking for something that is not exactly postmodern, but like kind of postmodern in the sense that it's a mishmash of like mythologies and stories from your entire culture or upbringing, plus the bureaucracy stuff. You get this like, you know, suddenly this god is making a guest appearance. And then suddenly there's like, oh, this, the villain of the week turned out to be like the bull of Lao Tzu that you see him riding around in your local temple or something. There's a bit of that, like you say, yeah, like callbacks to like references that would have been equivalent, I guess, the Ming Dynasty equivalent to like an 80s TV show or movie or whatever, the way that like Rick and Morty do that with like the giant heads or.
Yeah, they're just taking, or the author's just taking all elements from all these different stories and myths. Like there's very few original characters, I think, other than like some of the monsters of the week are just kind of a random spider demon or whatever, but a lot of them end up being these mythological creatures as well, or related to other figures. And my understanding is that Tripitaka is obviously based on a real person, so but my understanding is even Sun Wukong isn't entirely original, that there was kind of a tradition of other stories around I can't remember his real name, like Xuanzang, is it?
Xuanzang, yeah.
Xuanzang. I'm my pronunciations are also terrible.
All good.
But I think I understand that I think there was other like traditional stories around him, his pilgrimage, involving like even a monkey follower as well. Who may not have quite been the Sun Wukong in this story, but it's still based on a tradition of other stories.
Yeah, for sure. And then also I think there's, so the Wukong character, I hadn't thought about this until after the podcast, our podcast was basically over, but like the Ramayana has, I think, one of the main gods in that, the Hindu epic, the Ramayana, like his helper is Hanuman, and Hanuman is like a monkey god that is worshipped in, a monkey deity that's worshipped in India. And it kind of parallels it a little bit, because that figure is sort of a representation of us, and then the Hanuman kind of character is a helper of that. And so you kind of get something similar here, except of course the joke is kind of like that in the Ramayana that character is kind of a god and then he has a helper, and this is like, no, like the Monkey King is the god, and then this is just like a piddly little human who like kind of falls off his horse and pees his pants anytime they run into anything.
Very, very relatable.
Yeah.
Apart from, you know, the journey to enlightenment and all the rest of it. But, you know, I'm faced with a big scary monster. Scream and run away, or scream and piss your pants. That's what I would do in that situation.
Yeah, I think that's like what a lot of us would do. It's sort of that like Morty character, you know, like that's the representation of us. But these days, I think because we've been inundated with so much media, and we kind of hope that we're the hero, that most times it's like you see movies with like a vampire or a Godzilla like creature, and like you're not even fazed by it. But I think back then that representation is much more realistic. Like you might think that you can battle various monsters in your video games, but if you step out the door and actually saw like a building sized, like some of these monsters in this book are like hundreds of feet tall, And if you ever saw anything like that, I don't, like a giant kaiju, I don't think the response would be like, okay, I'm going to like walk up and punch this thing.
No. But
Rich and I have observed the video game adaptions to Journey to the West. It's always something like Mortal Kombat or whatever. And in the book, you realize Sun Wukong turned into a bug and he went inside their stomach and then did jumping jacks in there. Like, we'd like to see him an adaption that's a little more true to the source material. Like, it's not just like straight up. It'd be pretty boring if they just did you're reading about a kung fu fight every time.
He does do a little bit of that in I think in a Chinese Odyssey, but in basically every other regard, it's a very loose adaptation. If you've seen it.
Yeah, so how do you guys feel about that? Like, you know, having gone through, you know, 40 some odd chapters so far of the book and then kind of seeing the representations in the media, you know, in Asian media and whatnot. Like, I personally feel like there's this, they're like, Wukong is very much like a trickster figure in this novel. Like, he's kind of a jokester playing pranks all the time, even when he maybe should be serious. But then in the movies and stuff, I think there's like a movement or a cultural movement or whatever to really make him cool. Anything that I've seen recently, it's like he kind of jokes less and is meant to just kind of look cool or be serious. I wonder what you guys thought about that.
Maybe not the New Zealand adaption, which I haven't seen too much of, but I watched a little of it.
Oh yeah, that's fun.
New Zealand adaption's a really loose one, and intentionally loose.
Yeah, yeah, but that one's from like the 70s, though. I'm kind of, but sure.
Oh, there's one called the New Adventures of Monkey that's only a couple years old. Mm. Yeah, they kind of play Wukong in that as a kind of very vain, very full of himself, but kind of an idiot. In a way, he isn't really in the novel. Like, what? There's a joke that he's actually illiterate.
Oh, that's not good. I haven't seen any of the adaptations because the whole idea of ours is I'm going in cold and I'm reacting. But I wonder, because you're calling him a trickster, I definitely find him more of, you know, if anyone out there plays D&D, he's more of a rogue than a tank.
Right.
So I'm wondering just in future adaptations, just with the sort of popularity of stories like Loki at the moment, that maybe they'll lean into that a little bit more. I don't know.
I think definitely thinking of like Monkey, the BBC dub.
Oh God.
Show. And also Dragon Ball Z. I think both of those is like two very big. I feel like relatively big adaptations culturally. They both play up the, not really the trickster, but definitely the like non-heroic aspects of just really loving to fight.
Mm.
Where, I don't know, well, Goku in Dragon Ball Z and Dragon Ball is obviously heroic, but there's, I think he famously does things like spare Vegeta, not because he thinks Vegeta is redeemable, but because he just wants to be able to fight him again someday. Despite the fact that he like killed a load of his friends and was like trying to destroy the earth. He's just like, no, we should leave this guy live because I want a rematch.
Well, that part's not entirely inconsistent, I guess, because a lot of times in the book you get the end, you're like, wait, this guy just like, you know, usurped a throne and leveled an entire kingdom, and they're like, well, yeah, but he's like the pet rabbit of such and such, he's a high fancy bureaucrat, we have to let him go, and like he's just gonna go back to hang out in the heavenly palace or whatever.
Subordinates get slaughtered,
but we have we're killing all of his subordinates, but he's going back up there. Sorry, you were gonna say, MJ.
It's almost gone. Oh yeah, I wonder if a lot of that is due to, we talk about the concept of immortality a bit, and just it pisses me off for some weird reason. But I wonder if, you know, a lot of that is if you've lived hundreds of lifetimes, maybe you get bored. It's like, yeah, I want to fight this guy again. What else am I gonna do? I've got a few millennia, or possibly to the heat death of the universe to kill. I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. The heat death of the universe is probably like, even to someone who is immortal, is like a way long ways off. If you know you've got still a lot of days in between that.
Good few years, anyway.
Yeah, for sure. Congratulations, guys, on setting up your Patreon. I heard that recently. So you guys did the opposite of what we did, which is we like went out of the gate with a Patreon and then sort of let it fizzle out and just stop mentioning it, because we were like, we don't have enough followers for this. And then you guys actually built up a following and then got a Patreon, which is, I think, the right way to do it. So congrats.
Thank you. I wish we could say that was intentional.
I'm attributing intelligence to whatever good decision you make.
Yes, and thank you for bringing up that we have a Patreon so we didn't have to do it and sound greedy.
We are bad at promotion.
it's like the subtle head jerk to the like hat in the corner or whatever. Like, yeah, put your donations in there if you like our busking.
You can spare the price of a pint, lads. It was great entertainment. You know, also, we're going to stand right by the door as you exit and smile disconcertingly, direct eye contact. I actually used to work in an emerging art space where most things were donation, but when we passed around the bucket at the interval of whatever event, we would have someone standing by the door so nobody could exit. Just, you know, coincidentally, smiling unsettlingly.
Yeah. that's amazing. So I think how did you get into it, Quiva? Like you said you were reading a bunch of other, but why the Monkey King? What made you settle on this one versus say like doing a podcast on the Odyssey or an Irish epic?
I guess it was that's a good question that I hadn't really considered why I did it, try to do this over any other things. I guess it, like I said, it stood out to me that in many ways it felt like a very modern story, and it was just a very fun story to read. And I found myself wanting to like explain certain chapters to people. Mm-hmm. A couple of my favorites we still haven't gotten to in our podcast yet, so I won't say them now, but even just the chapter 3 with kind of barging into hell and
Sun Wu Karen.
Yeah, we've called this the Sun Wu Karen moment with Sun Wukong demanding to see the manager of hell because he wasn't meant to die because he's meant to be immortal, and just bossing his way in until he can see the actual official record, and his reaction just being to cross his name off the list and run away.
If anyone wants to do like some art of Wukong with the Karen Bob, would be so incredibly grateful. Like, have my firstborn grateful.
That's amazing. Yeah, I also like the reaction in that. Like, it's a typical bureaucrat reaction. It's like, you can't do that. There's no way. It just wouldn't be proper. You couldn't. And then like someone goes and does it and they're kind of like, oh, well, like they did it. I'm not going to like fight them on it, I guess.
Yeah, you know? This is above
my pay grade.
Yeah, exactly. You
know? They just pass it up the line to their manager. So it just goes to the Jade Emperor. And then the Jade Emperor's solution is this guy is causing too much trouble. So we need to just give him a useless job to take up his time.
Yeah, just give him something with a nice title, and just put him away and go, this is your department now, but just make sure he has no power over anything else in the organization, which is how you deal with a narcissist in a bureaucracy, which is amazing.
Yeah, and I just found myself wanting to explain some of these chapters and some of these storylines to people. And then, you know, it was lockdown and it was... needed to find some time to do and some projects to do, and I kind of talked MJ into this,
and I absolutely jumped at it because I was, at the time I was doing was doing a podcast called They Did What Now, which was just kind of like big what the fuck moments from history, which was pretty research intensive. And you know, I was also, this is when we all went nuts and just decided to live stream everything with just manic fervor, because we didn't want to admit that stage time was over. And I was trying to find, you know, lineups for these gigs. And a project where I just sat back and acted the clown sounded amazing. Thank you, Cuiva, for doing literally every single bit of work on this so I can just be the class clown and listen.
No worries.
That's great.
If the Patreon does take off enough, I might hire someone else to edit the episodes. That's the one thing I don't really like doing. But I'm happy to do everything else.
So how does the editing work for you guys? Like, how much time does it take up for you, Cuiva? Are you removing all the ums and ahs, or are you just sort of making sure?
I do a little bit. I try not to be over perfectionist with it, because I can tend to be that. But I basically just go through it once over, listening through it. If I'm repeating myself over and over again too much, or stuttering too much, or anything like that, I might clip some of it out. I generally don't have to with MJ, because MJ does not talk over themselves as much as I do. Sometimes we do talk over each other, especially if there's a bit of delay in the microphone, and so I try and clean that up as much as possible.
I know I've interrupted people like 6 times this very episode, but we swear it's not usually like that. Yeah, that.
But I just do it a once over and try and clean up anything that I think is too egregious. Basically, I guess it usually takes me. I would guess for, you know, every 10 minutes of podcast, it probably takes me 20 minutes to edit it.
Okay, that's much more editing than we did for our podcast, but that's quite good.
Like I said, I can be way too much of a perfectionist. So this is me trying not to go completely overboard with it, which I think I did do at the start. I spent much more time editing at the start of it. I tried to cut down on it. I think I probably made episodes sound worse by trying to cut them up too much, to be honest.
That's totally understandable. I was sort of the same way, and then till I realized I've got like 90 something more of these to do, and my wife would kill me if every week I just spent like 2 hours in a room trying to edit everything together perfectly. So then I kind of just went to keep the sounds at least normalized, because James and I are like in different countries and we call in, and so sometimes he's really loud and I'm really quiet, or vice versa. Yeah,
there's a kid in the background.
The kids, yeah. I also have a son and he has a daughter, and I've given up on that. I just let Andre scream, because I don't know. There's probably a sound engineer out there who could have told me how to take out the whiny scream of a child that goes underneath the surface of our dialogue, but I don't know how to do it. So I just left it. It kind of coincides with the characters in the book too. I mean, so maybe that's okay. I don't know. Do you have a favorite chapter, MJ? Do you have a favorite story or any aspect that you've really liked thus far?
I quite liked the episode with the the chapter even. It does feel very episodic. Is another thing that these events are all very self-contained, and then you occasionally have what I think of like as multi-parters, like thing with Hundred Flower Shame. But the chapter with the immortal fruits that look like babies that guarantee immortality that look like babies, because I love the comedy of the two immortal lads, which are great, and you've got almost like a sort of Laurel and Hardy element to that. And just then Tripitaka going, "I'm not eating a small child." What are you doing? I'm a vegetarian. Not that that should matter, it's a small child. And just nobody thinking to explain to him what's going on, because they live in an entirely different universe where this is normal. And I'm trying to I'm trying to think of the name of the god-like character, the monster of the week there. Was it the Great Sage equal to Earth?
Patriarch. They use it in our adoption. I think they use the term patriarch. Maybe not.
Okay.
But yeah, I recall, yeah, he's a... And that's where they all just flee at the end. Like, there's no, like, remorse. Like, we've done something bad, and there's no, like, attempt to, like, correct their transgressions.
No, I think they eventually get Guan Yin to fix the tree that they knocked over, and they do get forgiven.
And I am a massive fan of Guan Yin. As Quiva knows, I think that the person we bring in to get shit done, the terrifying trans queen who will sort things out, is really cool to me.
Yeah, that the calling her trans is one thing that it's fun, and I do feel self-conscious about that kind of joke though, because like she is an actual figure of worship, so I don't know.
This is true.
I don't know how much we should. I should explain in case you haven't like listened to that episode, I guess, where the mythological or the background of Guan Yin is an actual figure of worship, where she's a kind of a very Chinese, I think, interpretation of a Buddhist god whose name I don't recall, who in other traditions is usually depicted as male.
Mm-hmm.
And me and MJ are trans, so we kind of latched onto that as kind of as Guan Yin, as this kind of trans goddess as well.
Yeah, we're trying to I don't know, from my three quarters of a BA in English background, we did a lot of queering of the epics, so maybe I've got a hangover from that. Do sort of need to be careful with the implications of that, I do realize.
The door is open intentionally, I think, or there's at different times, so that wasn't like the prominent issues of the day, but they left the door open for us to walk in. We shouldn't just necessarily barge through. But
well, I don't know. I feel like that interpretation is open, and you guys are the first ones I've talked to from the queer community who are really into this story and also the character of Guan Yin. I think perhaps because of that, like I don't know if it's like intentional or if it's subtext or maybe just even subconscious, because like you see sometimes depictions of Tripitaka being played by a woman to try to represent his purity or something, perhaps. But Guan Yin definitely is interesting. You're right. He was initially, initially Guan Yin was like an Indian prince who had attained enlightenment and then decided to come back as a bodhisattva to help humanity. And then realize that, I guess, all the other, like there wasn't really a need for yet another male bodhisattva. So he became, he took on a feminine guise. Because I guess once you attain enlightenment and you give up your mortal body, you get to be whatever body that you want, sort of thing. And so there's definitely elements of trans and kind of like even drag, I think, in that, because a lot of drag performers are, well, I don't need to lecture to you guys about it, but that element of like looking for what the audience wants or needs and then becoming that either on stage or you know, as your persona.
That's interesting to me, actually, just as you're saying that it was kind of an intentional choice.
Mm-hmm.
Just because the small bit of reading I've done on this, which I'll admit is mostly Wikipedia articles, is kind of just made it seem like I don't think it was mentioned as this kind of intentional kind of different embodiment in the form of a bodhisattva, but it was just, the way it was written seemed more like it was just a different interpretation that happened over time in different traditions, rather than it being really a part of the story or the Guan Yin story of this being an intentional thing, which is interesting.
I don't want to sound like I'm sort of talking through my ass here, which, you know, to be honest, I kind of am, because I don't know. I am intentionally ignorant about the novel and probably more ignorant than I should be about the cultural context surrounding it, but you know, there is a tradition of queering, as I said, queering epics and mythology and all the rest of it, and an acknowledgement that imposing modern Western standards of what gender is on these texts is a crapshoot, you know, because our understanding of how gender works is not innate and it's not culturally stable across the globe. But there is something to be said for looking into it and looking at how translations, particularly Western translations, deal with things like that. And I mean, the best example I can think about for that is the Epic of Gilgamesh, where, you know, himself and Enkidu, that very, in a lot of earlier translations, very, very much a couple. And then you can see looking back or even forward to later translations, more Western translations, that element being eroded, whether it's just through a quirk of language or through, you know, this is not something that people in the West in this era either understand or want to talk about. So they kind of impose their ideas, what's going on it. I can't, you know, say with any authority that that is what's happening here, because again, I don't know, but it's an area of interest for me.
Yeah, that's very interesting that you say that, because I think also just as that happens going in one direction, where it's sort of like taking these epics that were more queer and then making it more straight, or sort of heterosexualizing it a little bit as cultures evolve and become more rigid, or gender roles in certain cultures become more defined, more strictly defined. You also have that, I think, a little bit with, or maybe even a lot with this too, because there's also the idea that, you know, this is the story that's told about Guanyin, but at the same time, perhaps what's happening is you see these statues of these bodhisattvas coming in that are like, the bodies of these statues are becoming more and more gender fluid, right? Like you get these like Buddhas that, these Buddha statues where they're kind of, they almost look like men with breasts, and then it starts to, they kind of lose muscle tone, etc. And so over time you could see how people misinterpret this character as being, you know, the character is intended to be somewhat trans, because the idea is once you attain enlightenment, what do you want to do with all the big muscles and stuff? You're kind of beyond that, and also your body doesn't have to conform either way. And that's sort of the suggestion by the artists or the artisans who create these things. And then the audience taking that eventually is like, well, at this point, it has to be either a male or female, because we've entered into our like strict heterosexual phase as a culture. So we're deciding that this one's a male and that one's a female and whatnot. But like you say, I think a lot of these deities are meant to be fluid, because again, once you've attained enlightenment, you've kind of moved beyond the duality of gender anyway.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting perspective on it. On a personal level, I quite like the idea that, you know, you obtain this level of enlightenment, and you kind of look at some of the social norms that are there, and you have no need for it. And I like the idea that it's kind of like, okay, I'm now too enlightened for gender. Screw it.
Yeah.
Just on a very base and, you know, not very analytic level, that appeals to me as a person.
Guanyin is a funny one. There's I remember we had a podcast a while ago with it was with a female professor, and she had mentioned that sometimes there's the like the fisherwoman guys that Guanyin takes on, which is a one that even now I'm finding kind of strange, because she'll be like a semi-nude fisherwoman on the path in like near fishing villages. And that is like, she's very attractive, obviously, and semi-nude. And the idea is that she seduces like fishermen, and then by the seduction, then is able to take that, I guess, lust for her and turn it into like a lust for enlightenment, and then thus convert them to Buddhism. So that is like almost, you can almost see that as like a drag character in and of itself, you know, like just as a lot of times there's a gimmick to some drag characters, her gimmick is to be like a semi-nude fisherman that's like fisherwoman that's like lost, you know, by the sea or something. It's almost like the reverse of the siren. Like instead of, you know, calling sailors to their doom, she calls them to enlightenment.
She's the fishnet stockings, but they're literally fishnets.
Yeah, exactly. Very cool.
There's also the Hamlet saying, I don't know, but get me to a fishmonger. And we talked to Scott Park Phillips, there'd be temples outside the walls that I think we could dive into. We got a historian on the show, but of brothels next to temples next. So there's a big spectrum there. I'm saying a whole bunch of seemingly unrelated facts, but if you could put the connection there, that there'd be a lot of interplay and there'd be more fusion between the brothel and the temple.
Right.
Prior to 50 or at certain times in history than we think of today. We would like to keep our brothels and temples separate.
Oh yeah, which for is sure.
A good innovation of you know, modernity to keep the brothels separate from the temples. But back then it was a pragmatic to have them nearby. Both were less stigmatized in the way we have them today. Maybe we're moving away from the stigmatization of the brothel a bit, but I'm not sure what I mean by we, but brothels were really isolated. At some time, people said we're really going to stick them in one section of the city and really control them and criminalize them. That was not the case through most of history. I think that was a part of it. With maybe Guanyin and had that at least the fish. Wife Guanyin, who's not well dressed, is a part of that.
Sorry, I was cutting into you there. Again, there's like a little bit of a delay. I think when we look at this stuff through a very Western lens, I think we tend to forget, just in the grand scheme of humanity's time on this earth, how recent a puritanical type of religion where sex is seen as dirty and just as very antithetical to the religious experience and as very much a bodily desire that gets in the way of spirituality. That's quite a recent thing. And you know, thinking back to sort of fertility goddesses and all the rest, but I find it interesting. It's sort of come around again. And if you think of spirituality and reaching some sort of understanding with God as leaving earthly things behind, leaving your sort of petty, bad, you know, small in the scheme of things, desires and anger and resentment and all the rest aside, you know, a lot of people, I know quite a few people who'd be active in the BDSM community who would describe being in subspace or in top space as a spiritual experience, because it's quite meditative. You're quite out of your head. You take on this role and things clear from your mind. Mm. So mentioning the brothels next to the temple, you know, it's interesting to me because, you know, the understanding of sex is antithetical to that kind of thing. It is quite recent. The brothels next to the temple sort of makes sense to me.
Yeah, for sure, MJ. And you mentioned like the Epic of Gilgamesh, and I know that in Sumerian times, perhaps either just before, like around the time of the epics or even before, like the epic, the temples were the brothels. Like there was no distinction because the Sumerian culture of the time saw sex as being sacred. And they worshiped, it was a lot more goddess worship. And so you would go to the temple and you would engage perhaps, or maybe just the kings, I'm not sure, but like there was like ritualized sex happening as a way to sort of experience the divine through a sexual experience. And the Sumerians of that time didn't see a necessary distinction between the two. Like you could attain enlightened or altered states through sex, sort of like what you were saying with the BDSM community. I can definitely see how the two can merge or were always the same, and only afterwards did we attempt to separate it as the West, or, you know, as modernity started happening, or however you want to describe it.
Yeah, I guess some people who practice that kind of thing would describe it that way. A lot of people just think it's freaking fun. Right. But yeah, no, the brothel being the temple is interesting to me, and just looking at Guanyin that way as sort of appealing to desire in order, it's almost like, hey, come meditate, I'm sexy. which is kind of interesting to me.
Guanyin as like the patron saint of like teenage boys trying to attain, or who don't even know they're trying to attain enlightenment.
Obtaining enlightenment so hard, you know, so many tissues floating around from my enlightenment.
I am clearing my mind.
Requires a lot of Kleenex. Yeah.
Yeah. Fascinating, amazing.
You requested tangents. I'm just throwing that out there.
No, this is great. Of course, this is also like, we started with the door is open, we shouldn't barge through, let's be respectful, to like Guanyin just being the goddess Kleenex floating everywhere.
I am so sorry.
Well, I'm not sure if you got to the chapter. The Journey to the West has done more disparaging things of Taoism than I think. Well, I don't know. We came pretty close to it, but throwing the idols in the latrine, and impersonating the idols. The idea that the text itself is not.
I think that's the cart slow kingdom. I think we haven't gotten there yet. I think we haven't gotten there.
Yeah, but this didn't mean to. But, just... Well,
no worries.
Yeah, we had a few guest speakers on, and Scott Pert Phillips he knows a lot about Taoism. It's a different perspective. He's going, well, it's very respectful and assertive from a certain point of view. And I'm doing a parody of, he's quite a lot more intelligent the way I describe it. And then we had Jim McClanahan, who's just a real enthusiast of Journey to the West, and he's going, this is us prepping before we got to this chapter. There's some parts of Journey to the West that are very hard to reconcile with it being respectful to Taoism. and we come to this and like, oh, that's what he's talking about. Like, but in general, all the deities being negligent, including Guanyin, including the Jade Emperor, not necessarily a malevolent, at least the upper tier, but that kind of the idea of a deity in the rest of the world, like, why doesn't Christianity exist? Well, what if bad things happen to good people? And the answer for at least why does religion exist for people in this era? Why do bad things happen to good people? Because the gods don't care about you that much. It's a really good answer. If you kind of have this idea that gods must love you and gods are, or a god is perfect, it's a lot harder to answer. But this worldview, at least it answers that question.
I feel like the perspective of the novel. I think the heaven and the Jade Emperor's court and everything are run very much like a government. They're practically indistinguishable from like the imperial government, other than instead of, you know, just dealing with taxes, they're in charge of making it rain and everything. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the perspective of the novel is that is the like good and just system, and that if, as long as things are running properly, it means prosperity. And therefore you should have great respect for, like, respect for the government and respect for the gods and nature are kind of overlapping in that regard.
I think the Chinese emperor was responsible for making it rain, least in a certain formal way. They would do ceremonies at the Temple of Heaven, for example.
Yeah.
And the government would be held accountable if there was a drought and there was no insufficient preparation. Accountable, I mean, there'd be a rebellion where hundreds of thousands of people would get in conflict, but...
Yeah, I feel like it's not so much the gods don't care so much as, you know, the gods have a lot to worry about, and there can be bad actors, you know. It's kind of like It's like the West.
Don't go to the Peach Festival, for Christ's sake.
But it's like the West Wing, you know, these systems, if you have the right people in the right systems running the government, you know, the systems will work very well, and you just might have bad actors or someone not doing their part correctly. And that's why bad things happen.
Well, yeah, but then there's also like bad things sometimes happen because perhaps the bureaucrat is working too hard, and then, you know, unlike the real government where like your dog gets loose and so big deal, you put up a missing poster and then they get the dog back. In this universe, like the dogs are also extremely powerful, like the pets. And so sometimes you get a case where like, I'm doing my best, I wasn't really paying attention, and then my dog somehow like usurped a kingdom and became the emperor or the king there or something, and is like causing misery and suffering for hundreds of thousands of people.
Answer is just like shrug emoji.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just saying I would read that fan fiction if anyone would like to.
The bureaucrat's missing dog. Yeah.
Yeah.
What if Brode took over took over part of Ireland. Sorry, the president of Ireland, Michael D. Higgins, has two huge
they're adorable
Bernese dogs that are, you know, very, very
they're beloved.
For, yeah, they're well liked. What I can't remember that
he's not fit for running the country, probably.
Yeah. I mean, the president of Ireland doesn't even run the country either. It's a ceremonial position.
Yeah, he signs bills into law as well. So there's a certain amount of analysis there. I don't know why I'm suddenly standing up for Michael D. Higgins. he's great. But yeah, not the same power as the US president, certainly.
But yeah, I guess if he was purely ceremonial, you could see like chaos happening if he let his dog take over or wasn't paying attention. His dog started vetoing laws that he was perhaps supposed to sign, I guess.
Since part of his job is representing us on the international stage, I think, you know, we'd have a lot of goodwill if Brode had that position. So just send Brode to meet Emmanuel Macron or whoever. I'm sure they'd be very happy with that.
Right. But yeah, so I guess, I think that kind of is Journey to the West as well. Like we notice sometimes the kingdom gets taken over by, say, you know, someone's assistant, and there's elements of it that are good. They're getting more rain than they ever were. But then there's other elements that are bad, like, you know, people are suffering or they're starving or what have you. So I could see like if Brode became like a foreign ambassador, how like you might get a lot of goodwill, but then at the same time he might cause an incident by like peeing on the carpet or something.
This is true. Not knocking over the priceless heirloom.
Yeah, exactly. But,
you know, with a lot of Western countries, that was probably stolen from somewhere. So if he ran off with it,
you know, right. But if he was to like mate with Angela Merkel's dog, and then you'd have this scandal, perhaps.
Or back to like, you know,
I think Angela Merkel is actually terrified of dogs. I think I remember reading that somewhere. Right.
Oh, yeah, that could cause problems.
Well, maybe like Putin's dog, perhaps. Like, I don't know what Ireland's official policy with Russia is, but if the dog, maybe that would actually be a good thing. Maybe they'd have dog peace. But perhaps,
yeah, I am thinking like Renaissance medieval Europe, where it was just like, I'm going to marry off my daughter to someone in your family so that there's peace between freaking England and France or whatever, but with dogs.
Oh, yeah.
We could bring that back.
Yeah, I think that's probably what's missing. If I was to redesign like the UN building, I'd put a giant dog park in the middle. So all the world leaders.
Right. Could, yeah.
Yeah.
We have a plan for world peace now. This has been a very productive episode. Thank you.
Yeah. Hey, it's all Journey to the West. I mean, apparently all the answers you could possibly want to have are found in this book, at least according to like the scholars who overanalyze that book, which is the other thing that I think that's kind of funny. It's like it's written by a bureaucrat and then overanalyzed by Confucian scholars, such to the point where I think it was like, this is what they did in the way that students today who have to like study for their exams end up like watching every single episode of Dragon Ball Z and as a way to procrastinate. Like people back then were like, we're going to pretend that this is really serious, or maybe not even pretend, like they took it very seriously. Like actually, if you read this book, you could also attain enlightenment, not that boring, like all those boring scriptures that we carted back from India way back in the day.
This is the Cliff Notes, but with monsters and, you know,
yeah, comedy. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's interesting how the modern day look at this is it's sort of just kind of a children's book. Like I can see why you would think it was a children's book, because our approach to the stuff of like the only places that talking animals and whatnot appear is in cartoons like SpongeBob or Looney Tunes or something. But at the same time, like you say, like there's a lot of heavy adult stuff that happens.
Yeah, I'm glad shows just on that note, just like shows like BoJack Horseman and Tuca and Birdie are getting made now. To use animation as more serious topics, but also like to have that kind of absurdist humor that they have as well, which is still very funny in a show for adults with sophisticated ideas as well, and not just SpongeBob, I guess. I don't know. I'm just going on a tangent because I really love BoJack Horseman.
I've seen a few episodes of that. I enjoy that as well. I like that they delve into deeper psychological issues. Like there's something wrong with BoJack, or at least you know, they question that, and just the idea that he's like an actor, but also like a horse actor is kind of hilarious too.
Yeah, it's another... I have bawled crying and like laughed my arse off at the same episode of that show. Which I think is that's kind of my highest praise, that it could make me laugh and cry like simultaneously. I think that's the best goal to aim for with any fiction.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that is what takes that piece of popular culture and turns it into something approaching art, if not outright art, right? It's that like the ability to really move somebody. Go ahead.
Sorry. Kind of want to bring that. I hadn't thought of this until you said it, but just sort of bringing that back to the novel, where there's so much, you know, surreal humor, so much about gods and governance and all the rest. But then when we're looking at deeper psychological stuff, I was really struck by the almost quite modern understanding of abusive relationship dynamics in the Hundred Flower Shame arc. Maybe that's something we imposed on it in translation, I'm not sure, but I remember having to take some breaks during the recording of those episodes because it was very, very real.
This again? Sorry.
The Yellow Robe Demon and the, what was it, the Black Rooster? No, not the Black Rooster Kingdom. I'm getting the names of everything mixed up now. When after Sun Wukong is banished, and Tripitaka ends up getting captured by, I think, the Yellow Robe Demon, and his wife is named Hundred Flower Shame. And there's kind of I don't know, we kind of dove into their relationship a lot, and kind of her perspective. And I feel like I, with the perspective, I'm kind of dictating the perspective maybe a bit more than I want to with the format that we have, because you're like seeing the book, MJ, entirely through my reading.
This is also true. Yeah.
But it's quite dark because she was kidnapped or misled, at least.
Yeah, yeah. She was
isolated from her family. Yeah.
For years, she's two children from this monster who she was kidnapped by.
She was kidnapped by, you know, I think we see a couple of scenes where he hits her, but she can't leave. She wants to leave, but she feels she can't for several reasons. She blames herself a lot. going into it. And then we go back to where her family is, and obviously, you know, dynamics in that time when it came to marriage and daughters were very, very different. But she gets a lot of blame and abuse from them as well. And it was just interesting to me looking at that and just seeing, maybe I'm very much imposing my own understanding there, but just seeing the cycle and the way she reacts to things and the way she behaves and even the way she speaks felt very real to me as someone who would have suffered both parental and spousal abuse. As somebody who would have in modern times is what I'm trying to say. It felt very real.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's tough to talk about intent because I think sometimes you have the author who's collecting, the author's putting his own view, but he's also collecting stories that pre-existed. So I don't know what the intent of a story is. I'm collecting it and stylizing it in some respect.
Yeah,
but like over the course, it's tough to say. There's the author, especially at the end of that, he kind of puts in that, yeah, she's reincarnated.
It's very much polished away.
And then this was destined, brushed away. Like he's going out, the author's going out of his way to not put that perspective. The door's naturally opened by the substance of the plot, but the author's going out of his way to not make that important. At the end.
Yeah, and there is at the end of that story, there is this part of how they were both these deities in heaven who kind of reincarnated and eloped, and she doesn't remember this, and it's kind of this supernatural explanation for the whole plot. And her, and after that is revealed, she kind of her and her perspective kind of disappear from the plot entirely. I don't think we ever really get her reaction to any of that, hearing any of that, if she ever does, or her perspective on this story at all after that. It's just kind of it's explained, and any kind of the emotional angles are kind of entirely dropped. I think the author wasn't focusing on that aspect of the story.
But
up until that point, but it was there. Like she does. There is this back and forth where she's trying, you can clearly see her trying to manage the emotions of is it Yellow Robe Demon? Am I getting that name right?
It's Yellow Robe Demon. But it is very much brushed away by the author under the framework he was writing in. But I was struck, like, as you said, writers collect stories. I was just struck by how true to life that was, and how it shone through even despite what happened at the end.
Yeah, that is a very interesting story, like a very psychologically very deep, I think, too. I think that like it's one of those subjects that even we as moderns are still kind of grappling with it, because if I recall correctly, she kind of also develops a little bit of Stockholm syndrome. Like it's not purely that it's not at that point, like she's already built a family with this guy, even though she doesn't want to, but she also kind of cares for the mixed children, like the part demon, part human children that she has. So there's a lot of conflicting emotions in that.
It's very much a disorganized attachment where the only source of comfort and the main source of pain are the same individual. So yeah, I don't know. I was just very struck. It felt very much a whiplash, to me after all the, because it's put away under a certain framework, but it is very much not played for laughs. I think. So just that moving the emotional tone when Queeva mentioned BoJack Horseman. It was interesting to me, and it very much hooked me more on the novel. Just that tonal shift in it.
Yeah, I think it's quite brilliant that he does have, like, that he's able to work moments like that in there. And I think we, while we're reading it, because some of this novel is quite, you know, I don't want to say simplistic, but like you say, it's like played for laughs, or the tone is kind of like more straight. And so you get to something like this, and then we kind of want to put that same approach to it. So we're kind of hoping for a happy ending or some explanation that makes, I guess you could say, like, more sense towards the end of it. But perhaps this is sort of just how societies back then had to deal with it. You know, you have this horrific situation happening in your village. It doesn't end with like a great resolution. And so the best you have is like bring in an authority figure, like a religious authority, to tell you that actually in a past life, you know, this all makes sense now because in a past life there's something owed or some kind of, it is kind of like a supernatural, like hand waving explanation, but like that's kind of the best that you can do. And at least that provides, even if it's minimal closure, some amount of it so people can kind of move on. I think that's cool. Kind of the best that they were, that's kind of what's happening towards the end of this story. Because if you read some of the Hindu texts, you get that a little bit where like some so-and-so is like a saint and then he's brutally murdered. And then the followers of Buddha are like, what the hell happened? Like, I thought good things were supposed to happen to good people. And then the Buddha would explain like, well, you don't see the guy's past life. He was actually horrific, murderous to his parents, or like murdered his parents or whatever. And so this is payment in this life. And it's not a satisfying explanation to moderns because we don't necessarily take it for granted that there's going to be an afterlife and there was a pre-life. But I think back then, in order to keep people from obsessing and dwelling and, you know, grieving forever, that was the best way they could kind of close the door and get people to move on with their lives. But that's just a thought. I don't know.
It's a very interesting point.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry to really drop the tone there. I apologize.
Well, the other thing was like
discussion.
So you say that the, like, it's not, that story is also weird because like the author has that thing where like they take this part of the story really seriously, but they don't take her kids seriously at all.
You know, no, they're like, just murdered.
So just throw them out of the sky.
Apparently, murdered
as like a provocation, and the provocation doesn't even work.
It's like, well, Mac, yeah, kids died, whatever.
Like, yeah, it's also that struck me as so strange because, like, you say they're kind of half human, half demon children, and I think does Anthony Yu translation use abomination or something similar at some point? There's definitely the children are seen as a negative thing, at least from the kind of this relationship from the demon kidnapping her, etc. But it's so odd because the way the novel doesn't treat like a demon as a thing that you're born as and you're just a demon forever. Like, it repeatedly refers to like the times when Wukong and Wu Jing and Baji used to be demons and like that they're not anymore. Mm-hmm. And demon is kind of a thing, is kind of more of a practice of what you're doing and how you behave. Mm-hmm. So it seems very strange that these children are just kind of disregarded as being inhuman and able to be killed just very casually. It struck me as very, you know, I was trying to really figure out the perspective of what the word demon means in the context of this story.
Yeah. Just saying that, you reminded me of... I think it's the 13th Warrior. It's terrible. I don't know why. Maybe I shouldn't even be bringing it up. But like, Antonio Banderas plays like a Muslim adventurer in the night in like I think it's like pre-medieval post-Roman like Britain or something. And then it's basically a retelling of Beowulf, but instead of the Grendel, the evil monster, being an actual monster, he's just sort of like a half ape, like a primitive human, and like Beowulf isn't the godlike hero that he is. He's just a man, and I think you can almost do that kind of a telling of Journey to the West, where the demons aren't really demons; they're just either foreigners or, say, barbarians, if you want to use that term. You know, because there are cultures and there are tribes around China which were very much into like animal worship, and you can see how like to someone from quote unquote civilized China, someone who perhaps puts on the mask of a bull or a, or some other animal could seem like a demon transformed, right? So in a way, like this is, it's not, they're not necessarily demonic. I guess you can, if you want to see it that way, you can. And the children are quote unquote unnatural, but at the same time, like this book makes it quite clear that sometimes if you, even if you were a demon, if you cultivated yourself enough and practiced being a good person enough, you actually could become a good person and become what's considered human in the novel. And it's vague a little bit, what is exactly a human. So yeah, that part also threw us off. And it's just so shocking that I think the only response that we had was kind of like disbelieving laughter. Yeah. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think
sorry, Camila.
No, I was just going to say on the like becoming human. Yeah. I think they do. I think the author does mention like the idea of Wukong having become human as well at some point during the cultivation, mm-hmm. which I think.
Wukong self-describes himself as they all describe themselves as men. The author never does that, or he doesn't do it very often, that omniscient third person, like Wukong's a man. Wukong, when they ask, what are you? And Wukong and Wu Jing and Wunang, they say they're men.
It might be the Jade Emperor, someone in his court. I think someone refers to Wukong as having attained human form, but that, which is, you kind of assume that's physical, but everyone still describes him as still like being a monkey and looking like a monkey. So I'm not entirely sure of the outlook on this as well. My kind of understanding I've come to is kind of becoming human is more of a level of kind of enlightenment and of attaining like a human soul more than a human physical form.
Mm-hmm. I think it's like you say, it's like they've adopted like human mannerisms and like human behavior too, like human culture essentially. One of the things that we don't think about as much, I think, as moderns, because we're perhaps a little too obsessed with like the beach bod or whatever, is that like in medieval China, the depiction, or even like in Egyptian times, right? The depiction of higher class, quote unquote, or more sophisticated or more civilized peoples is the clothes that they wear. And so that's also part of it. Like he went from being a naked ass monkey to like someone who can wear clothes and dress like a human and talk like a human and like, you know, listen and fight like a human. And so thus he's basically a human. Because one of the things is like in medieval Chinese paintings, like the guys who are like shirtless with rippling muscles and stuff are actually the demons or the demon guardians or whatnot. It's this idea that like you still haven't really mastered your beastliness, I guess you could say, or whatever part of you that isn't human. And then the sages and the people who are enlightened are always depicted as wearing these like flowing robes and you know, being totally calm and not taken away by their emotions. And part of that is because like their rippling muscles aren't like they're not like roided out, I guess you could say.
It's really interesting to me that you kind of mentioned the quote-unquote barbarian angle, because again, I'm coming into this with very little knowledge of both the novel and the cultural context, but mm-hmm. I was just thinking about how many times we see these demons trying to usurp positions of power in human kingdoms, so I'm wondering if there's a certain sort of cultural anxiety that's coming through there. It kind of reminds me of the sort of 1950s, 60s British and American plays and films where it was quite Reds under the bed, and you see these working class male quote sort of brutish characters in suddenly gaining positions of power and status, like in plays like The Streetcar Named Desire, films like The Servant, where you know, either they're now marrying former society women, or they're turning the balance of power in households by, you know, taking over the position of the master and things like that. So,
oh, definitely.
I'm just wondering of your perspective on that as people who know their shit, which I do not.
Well, we sort of know our shit just by osmosis, I think, because we've hung around with a bunch of these people who are experts on the culture and history and whatnot. Sorry,
There is a history in China, isn't there, of becoming I'm not sure how to even describe it, of like, I was going to say a vassal state of the Mongol Empire, but it's not even that, because the Chinese kind of China retained its structure, right, but with just a Mongol emperor on the throne.
Yeah, that's you're referring to Kublai Khan and then his descendants, and yeah, the Mongols basically they conquered China, but then what's interesting about the novel Journey to the West is apparently it has its origins, like the first written versions happened during the Yuan Dynasty, which is during the Mongol domination, and one of the inferences that historians make is that this was perhaps a way of justifying the need for all three religions in China to say like a despot who took over, who probably is from a completely different culture and doesn't understand why like there are temples everywhere and why, like, if I had to pick one, like, which one should we fund, the Buddhists or the Taoists? Like, why do we need to support so many religions? And then this would be like maybe a Taoist or a Buddhist bureaucrat's explanation of why you need all of them, is like, let me tell you this story. And it incorporates a lot of myths and it keeps the attention of like a horse riding nomadic barbarian general who's used to just slaughtering people and doesn't think too much about the deeper metaphysical epistemology of Chinese culture. So that's one of the explanations. And if you look at it from that lens, then this is also a piece of perhaps like cultural propaganda. And so one of the things that's interesting about this whole time period is that there is definitely that fear going on, because you have, you know, prior to this, the view was that China was the center of the universe. It almost basically was the civilized universe. It's so populous. It's such a large landmass. They can't really imagine a whole lot that goes on beyond it. It's just sort of like, kind of like a Game of Thrones, where it's like there's the stuff behind the wall, which is us humans, and then everything beyond that we'll just consider like white walkers and demons and whatnot. And so to have this demon kind of sitting on the throne being like, hey, like, why do I need to like keep these temples in good shape again? And then this is the explanation. And then over time what you have is like a cultural absorption, because Kublai Khan starts out, you know, his grandfather Genghis Khan had like contempt for China. He starts kind of respecting it more, like tries to learn the language. There's some debate over whether he ever really learned how to read and write Chinese, but like his grandsons and later generations are like composing Chinese poetry, etc. So there's like a cultural absorption element that's happening, which I think is kind of, this also plays into like, well, you know, like the Chinese gods are looking out for this, the bureaucrats are handling it, even if the kingdom is being taken over by a barbarian, so to speak.
Sorry, I'm sorry. That's really interesting. I don't really have anything to.
I'm just absorbing it. That's a very interesting piece of information. Thank you for giving your take on that.
Oh yeah, sorry if that was. I know that like some. That's part of our thing, is we go off on these historical tangents, and we're like just barely above talking out of our ass too. So we could be wrong in some points, but we do know that the novel, this version of the novel that we're reading, all the translations are based off of Ming Dynasty translation. So that's when the Chinese peasant uprising basically kicked out the Mongols again. So now it's officially a Chinese empire. So I think that there's also a level of remove where these stories can end happily, because there's a faith in that, like maybe even when the wrong king takes over for a while, eventually the good king or the right one will come back, or some version, like we'll get the son back on the throne, or, you know, the official heir or whatever. And so that's kind of what you have as well in these stories.
Yeah, no need to apologize for the historical tangent. We love a good info dump. Thank you for the perspective on that. That's a lot to think about.
Yeah.
Just to add on that, how Mao was an admirer of Journey to the West, the first Ming emperors, so talking out of my ass, like, but they're also from peasant backgrounds. The idea of someone like Wukong, who's very effective in some ways, such as fighting, but maybe doesn't know the finer points of etiquette. Certain, the first Ming emperors and his hanger, the hanger-ons, and then shortly after, they tried to, you know, get the aristocratic people in Nanking, but they moved the capital to the militarists from Beijing. So there's this lot of the people who are getting things done, like Mao, like the first Ming emperors, they're using very crude means, kind of like Wukong is. They're using they're thinking on the fly. They're using brute force, trickery. Yeah, but not like trickery isn't well thought out plans. They're doing what needs to be done to get them through this. It's kind
it's all
of
sort of improv.
The way that mm-hmm. yeah, the way that Mao allegedly really empathized with Wukong might be also kind of the way the Ming, certain aspects of the new elite of the Ming society might also empathize. Like they might not be necessarily all the established gentry that are the Confucian scholars like Tripitaka. But we need to get these softies to safety. We need someone tough and gets things done to, you know, get them to where they need to go. Right. That idea that, yeah, so it's there. It can justify a whole lot of interesting policies. But
not the hero we deserve, and the one justify, we need right now.
Yes.
Yeah, totally. Well, I think we're just about out of time, but it's been so good talking to you guys. We'd love to perhaps do this again somewhere down the road.
Absolutely. It was,
yeah, fascinating. Yeah,
it was lovely.
Great. And so for listeners out there, like, please give Journey of the Monkey King a subscribe and a download and all your hard-earned money, because who yes. needs money anyway when you're going to become enlightened? So, yeah, please give them a listen. Is there anything else you guys would like to add?
Well, thank you for having us on.
Yeah, thank you. We are famously bad at ending our podcast. I'm wondering if you guys would mind dropping a link to our social media in the show notes where you can find out about our other projects.
No, of course not. Please send that by us then, because I was just going to link to like your podcast page. But if you have other projects, etc., please send them, and we'll make sure to include it in the notes and in the Twitter mention.
Okay, great. Sweet. Thank you.
Thanks.
Great. Cool. Well, thank you. And to the listeners, we're also potentially planning a book now that we've gotten to the end of it. So we'll keep you guys updated on that as well. Cuiva and MJ, thank you again. I guess journey on.
Journey on.
Journey on. That's an excellent sign off.